Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your Chantress of Everything Valuable and Beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. A really special program today because came across my computer screen that the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, my favorite place in Santa Barbara, by the way, is doing two things that I'm really, really excited about. Number one, they're expanding their educational space and they're expanding the educational programming, notably an art learning lab, etc. And new funds are going towards this because the Ridley Tree Education Center at McCormick House has been sold. And so that is super, super exciting. Second, I want to talk about the 2025 exhibition schedule, which I think is phenomenal. It's a conversation between essentially two eras, and the duality thing is kind of an important part of the season because there's a lot of collaboration going on. Notably, the Impressionist Revolution, Monet and Matisse from the Dallas Museum of Art. I want to talk about that and how a collaboration happens. I have the director, Amada Cruz, with us, and we've had her on the program before. She's a phenomenally gifted woman, and she's our head of the museum. And Patsy Hicks, who's been with the museum as education director for a long, long time. Patsy, I've known Patsy actually 20 years, something like that, Patsy?
I think so, you're right.
yeah. Around 20 years with the museum. So I want to start out with Amada talking a little bit about the season, which, just a little quick overview. We start with Sea of Ice, Echoes of the European Romantic Era. So we're focusing on the mid-19th century to the end of 19th century. We move to a really interesting concept, conceptual math and art, geometry, numbers and graphs, et cetera, and the way to understand, you know, art through the art of the cipher. And then we go to proscenium, Elliot Hundley. I don't know much about that artist. I'm interested to find out. By Achilles' Tomb, Elliot Huntley, and Antiquity. Here again, we get this contrast between old and new. Letter forms. So always the written symbol has been very important. I'm thinking of John Baldessari, et cetera. I want to talk about that. Vienzora, Outer Worlds. Now we move towards a multi-venue mid-career survey of an internationally renowned abstract painter who was born in Baghdad. And this is also a collaborative show. I want to talk about that. Mario Giacomelli, The People and the Earth, an Italian artist, post-war, post-World War II. Props and Icons, again, the symbol, with Rose Solane. Impressionist Revolutions, Monet and Matisse. We talked about that from the Dallas Museum of Art. Sure to be an incredible show. Encore, 19th century French art at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. Wow. Curated by Charles Wiley. Love Charles. And then we've got exhibitions on view we can talk a little bit about that are on view right now. But I want to have Amada talk about, first of all, Amada, how did you choose the season? Is it something that you get together with your staff? Is it your work entirely? How do you choose a collaborator in another institution? Talk to me a little bit about the process.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us on the show. It's really fun to take a break from a Friday morning and talk a little bit about art. So yes, how do we do collaborations and how do we put together the season? It really is a conversation with me and the exhibition curators, the curators at the museum. And we ideally look out 2 to 3 years in planning these things, because they do take quite a while to organize, especially with collaborations, because of course, when you work with other people, it just takes more time. But it is a lot more satisfying, in my opinion. So let me just backtrack a little bit and sort of give you an introduction to what's happening at the museum. We very recently reinstalled our American and European collection. And normally that's considered a sort of traditional, if you think about the way you've seen it at other museums in the past, it's a pretty traditional chronological installation. In this case, our chief curator, James Glisson, led the curatorial team, and they decided to mix things up a little bit and inject the galleries a little bit of energy. So what we have is a show of our permanent collection called Modern Life, A Global Art World, 1850 to 1950, where the curators were mixing things from artwork that was European, American, Latin American. The museum, you probably know this because you've been a longtime fan, has a really strong collection of Latin American art. And we even have photography in there and even some Japanese prints. And the thesis of that exhibition is really that artists, by the 19th century, there was, you know, communication and artists really collaborating with each other. And those geographic boundaries perhaps were becoming a little bit more porous. And so there was a lot of dialogue between all these different kinds of work and artists. And the show is actually thematically based. So we have an area on abstraction, another wall on global surrealism, and it's become very, very popular. And that really, in a way, introduces the shift, perhaps, in the exhibition schedule, but also in the way we think about our permanent collections. So we very much think about a mix of things. We are so lucky at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art that we have this fantastic, eclectic collection, which is global. We have art from all over the world. So by definition, it is multicultural and diverse. And we want to really celebrate that and perhaps even play with that a little bit. So when we think about our exhibition and permanent collection display schedule, we do think about offering as much as we can to different types of viewers, you know, what the folks who really like contemporary art, we have something for them. The folks who really like 19th century French art, for example, we have a really wonderful collection of French impressionist work. We really do want to give people different sort of access points to our collections. And it's a long conversation, and sometimes it's hard to schedule things, but in this case, we're pretty pleased about the lineup of exhibitions that are coming. We're also sort of playing with different spaces. So, for example, when you first walk into the museum, you have that beautiful Ludington Court, right, with all the Greco-Roman works. And in this case, we're going to have an artist who is from Los Angeles working with our Greco-Roman antiquities and reinstalling that in that courtyard, the introduction to the museum. So you really do have this sort of clash and conversation between the contemporary and the ancient. And we're pretty excited about that. The museum actually has a wonderful, rich history of using that Ludington Court as an experimental space for different artists to work with and play with our collection. And so we're going back to that tradition with the Elliott Hundley exhibition, which opens on April 20th. So I'm very happy that you actually noticed how different and how varied our exhibitions are coming. So because that is very much something that we think about. In terms of collaborating with other organizations, it is something that a lot of museums do. And I think doing more of it is probably in our future, because that means that we get to collaborate with other institutions that perhaps have collections of artworks that we don't have, right? So we can sort of fill in the blanks, let's say, by using other museums' collections, and they can use ours. But also it's an opportunity to take advantage of exhibitions that perhaps we don't have, really deep holdings in certain materials, but we have some material and then we can sort of add our own. And an example is the Impressionist Revolution, Monet to Matisse from the Dallas Museum of Art. That is going to be a really extraordinary exhibition because that collection is world renowned. And so we will have that collection on view in the fall and through the holidays. And it also gives us an opportunity to do an exhibition right next to it, which is part of the show in many ways, where we celebrate our own collection of 19th century French art, including incredible photography that people may not even know about. So we're pretty excited about all of this.
I have a question, Amada. I want to ask you about In the Making Contemporary Art, which is on now through, it just left us.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, it just left us, right. Went to see it. I was struck because, you know, I've been an appraiser for 30-something years. A lot of people, my clients in this town, remember when the museum sponsored a lot of local really good artists. And my clients sometimes have in their collections artists that they purchased that were deaccessioned or shown at the museum. And this is early days, 60s, 70s, something like this. And it seems to me that when I was looking at In the Making, I was reminded of that tradition of the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, that they do acknowledge many contemporary artists. That was sort of different for its time. Am I on the right track here with what I'm seeing?
Please correct me if I am if I'm misunderstanding you. I think your question is our relationship to contemporary artists, but particularly local contemporary artists.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
What you're asking? Yes. So the museum has had a really wonderful tradition of supporting local artists. And we actually have a mandate which says that we should be showing the work of artists who work in California. And the museum has done so in the past, and we are certainly doing that now as well. And part of that, it's, you know, not just local in terms of Santa Barbara, but also California wide. But it doesn't only come through in the exhibitions, it also comes through in our acquisitions. So we also collect the work of California-based artists as well. So that's something that we're going to continue to do.
Okay, I have another question, which is a metaphor, analogy, et cetera. So my early background in the arts was in ballet. And so I danced when I was younger and was in a couple of professional companies for years until, you know, you turn 33 or so and you're out. But I remember with panic, right before a show was going to open, it seemed that you were rehearsing, and nothing was coming together. And then when the show opens, everything comes together. It's like magic. The curtain opens and all of a sudden everybody's doing what they need to do. I'm wondering if that's the same when you start, when you actually open an exhibition. Is it chaos, 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 and then boom, it works?
That's such an interesting question, actually. And I want to say, Elizabeth, I actually was a baby bunhead myself. So I appreciate that you were a fellow.
Yes.
You know, yes, to a certain extent, that's true. I mean, it sort of depends on the exhibition and how elaborate the installation is. But I do think that what you see when you walk into the museum, especially now when we're installing the Elliott Huntley exhibition right in that introductory gallery when you first walk in, it looks like chaos, right? It looks like a mess. And then, yes, all of a sudden it all comes together. You know, the lighting is the last thing that you put up with some last minute labels perhaps, and it all starts to look, you know, really perfect. So it's funny that you asked that question, but I think you're absolutely right. I think there's, you know, there's a certain element of performance to opening an exhibition, right? So much work behind the scenes, and a successful exhibition can be, you know, defined in many ways. But I always think if it looks really perfect and effortless, then there's probably a ton of work that went behind the scenes. So that's a very astute observation. Yes.
It's interesting, though, just when you mentioned the Elliott Huntley, which is somewhat of an empty space in Ludington Court now with this lovely Hermes, though, bathed in pink light. And so one person's open space or chaos yesterday turned out to be one couple who just got married. It was the background of their photos for their wedding. They came in and they were so excited to sit at the base and be bathed in that light. It was just, it was so great to see. So
That's
you never
wonderful.
Know how people will interpret things.
You know, I'm reading about the Achilles Tomb. The title is By Achilles Tomb, Elliott Huntley and Antiquity. There's such a aura of, you know, sanctity around ancient Greek sculpture of all kinds, and you know the sculpture that's in Ludington Court, etc. Do you feel that there's a little bit of sacrilege here, or how do you look, Amata, at this kind of choice? In other words, I guess you could explain what Huntley's actually doing inside.
Right. Well, it's, you know, I don't want to ruin the surprise, so right. I won't go into all the details. But he is going to be mixing his own sculptures, which were quite Baroque in a certain sense, and layered and made of lots of bound materials, with our own collection of Greco-Roman sculpture. And it's funny, sanctity. I think the reason that there is this aura of sanctity around that kind of work is the sort of mystery behind it. We don't know who a lot of the artists are who actually created those sculptures, those statues, let's say. But also, we grow up seeing images and they're all very white, right? And they look very pure in a certain way and very monochromatic. And if you look at the images of ancient Greece, you know that actually so many of those sculptures were polychrome. They were actually colored, right? They had like crazy gold on them and, you know, blues and reds. And so it looked a little bit more playful, perhaps, right? There was a lot of color. And so I think that my idea of this work is a little less, you know, I think of these a little less precious. Not that they're not precious objects. I think all artwork is to a certain extent, but I also, you know, these were works that were actually, they were statues. And I use that word in a very definite way. They are statues. They're meant to represent the gods, but they were very colorful. And people, you know, in Greece lived with those statues, right? They weren't just, they were on pedestals, but they were very much, they represented something that impacted their lives. And so I think him, a contemporary artist, Elliot Huntley, coming in and adding works to that installation and putting his own sort of stamp on an entire room is going to be interesting for us to see that kind of, those ancient works can still have some kind of impact in the way that we see our contemporary world. So it'll be interesting for people to see that. Yeah. I also was a contemporary art curator for a long time and worked with many artists on this exact kind of practice, with them going back into European or into more historical collections and actually extracting information and using them in their own installations and works. So I'm very familiar with this kind of way of working. And I think it's also really exciting to have a dialogue between the old and the new. So I think it'll be interesting for people. So far, the response from our audiences to this idea of using Ludington Court and our sculptures, those Greco-Roman antiquities, as material for other contemporary artists, the response has actually been quite positive and curious, right? People really are curious about what that's going to look like.
Interesting. I was thinking more about, you know, the 18th and 19th century attitude, you know, of classicism being sacrosanct, you know, and archetypal, and you know, the idea that this is a encapsulation of Achilles' tomb.
Yeah,
I was thinking about that. Well, it should be super interesting to see.
Yeah,
super interesting to see. Interesting that part of the press release about this says it talks about the fourth wall being kind of broken through, and it talks about ancient culture can be remade and repurposed today by anyone from anywhere, no expertise in ancient Greek required. That phrase kind of was interesting to me because you're, I think, suggesting, Amata, that we can see with new eyes. We don't have to see through the lens of the 18th and 19th century in regards to their religiosity around the Greek gods. It's just going to be super interesting. I think it's really very, very, I don't know. It's like a rich meal. You know, you want to sit down and think about every course.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, that's exactly what we want to provide for people. So thank you for that. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great observation.
Richard, I'd like to talk a little bit more when we get back from the break about the educational programming. And I think that's so important. And the new opportunities for educational programming that the museum is going to be faced with because of the sale of the Ridley Tree Education Center. I want to talk about that and how exciting it's going to be. And we have, I'm looking at 4 or 5 pages of programming that's going to happen, which is just super exciting. To whom is this going to be directed? To what age group? To what communities? And I want to hear about that from Patsy Hicks, longtime educational director at the museum. Richard, let's go to quick break. We'll get back. We'll talk a little bit about. And Ahmad, I wonder you could introduce for me Patsy, and tell me a little bit about what the input is of the rest of the staff around it, the educational programming, and yourself as means of introduction. Yeah, when we get back from the break. Okay, let's go to quick break, Richard. Don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I am pleased to be and honored to be talking with Amada Cruz, the director of the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, and Patsy Hicks, longtime educational director of the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. And I asked Amada if she would introduce Patsy and also introduce some of the really interesting happenings in regards to education and outreach, community outreach, to whom the educational programming is addressed, to what age group, et cetera, et cetera. And maybe, Ahmad, if you could talk about maybe 2 or 3 of the new programs that you are most excited about.
Yes, thank you, Elizabeth. Well, it is my absolute pleasure to be introducing Patsy Hicks, who, as you said, has been at the museum for a very long time, decades, actually. And she is an extraordinary educator. And her team and what they do for our communities is really just so exemplary. And I'm so proud to be working with them because they do a really wonderful job of really engaging different audiences from little kids to, you know, adult kids, let's say. So we have such a rich array of offerings. I'm not sure that I have a favorite, to tell you the truth, although we are all quite charmed by the preschoolers who have been coming recently to the museum, the little ones, who we now know they come to the museum. They last for about 15 minutes, Patsy told me, before they start rolling around on the ground. but it's really fantastic to have the really little ones with us and then going all the way forward. So I think I'll just give the microphone over to Patsy because she is really the one who runs these extraordinary programs.
Well, thank you for that, Ahmada. And I feel, as you said, Elizabeth, it's an honor, really, and a pleasure, truly, to work with Ahmada and the entire team at the museum. And the exhibitions that were teed up in that first part of the show are really the reason behind everything we do. It's making that connection between people and art. And Ahmada referenced a new program. It was new last year and continued this year. And we are working in tandem with the school district for all the preschool students that are in the public school program, and they have a multiple site initiative to introduce these little guys to public institutions, and the museum is among them. And so for a full month, they come to us, and we call it, the whole program is called Literacy Moves, because it's combined with the idea of reading literacy. And so we have vocabulary words in Spanish and English that are chosen by the district and that get repeated in varying ways. So not only are these little people exposed to an institution they might not have visited before, but they have a familiarity with the language from their own classrooms. And they come to the museum really just to learn to look. And we have these, one of our teaching artists created these frames through which they look. It helps them focus So they sort of aim it at different artworks as directed, and they get to, it's always good for them to use their hands. So they're making things with this air dry clay, which leaves no residue, which is kind of magical. And to see these little ones lower than the cases, but to look up with awe at, for example, Dario Robledo's installation of whale ear bones and butterflies. And just, if you ever doubt that museums' purpose is in part to share wonder, then you would be convinced that that happens here. And the joy, not only in this little 3 to 5 year olds, but their parents who come along too, and perhaps have not felt that they had a way into the museum. I think it makes them feel more comfortable too. And we and the staff often line up just to see them because they are so cute. And it makes you think, yes, we're in the right place doing the right thing.
How cool is that? and as far as age ranges, Amata talked about the adult children as well.
Go ahead.
Please tell me more.
Well, we try to serve from the youngest, and I sometimes we have parents with babes in arms coming through, and we welcome them. And whenever they walk into something in the auditorium and they're concerned that their child might cry, we say, that's life, let them cry, we do not mind, we welcome that. So we serve the preschool audience and then all the way through university level of students. But also we do a number of programs specifically for adults and some that are just generally welcome to all. So for example, when we have our Family First Thursdays, they're open to anyone. And what we often find is that adults and often college students end up in the space making art because we as adults don't often take the time for creative play, and everyone needs and benefits from that. And then we have programs directed more to an adult audience. I think, Elizabeth, you've been a great supporter of Parallel Stories, where we bring artists or musicians into conversation with the artwork. Very popular with adult audiences. The lectures by our contemporary artists and curators and specialists who come to the museum. The kinds of programming with dance and music that can take place on the front steps, like our collaborations with the symphony or Opera Santa Barbara. You know, nothing makes me happier than to see those young opera singers standing out on the terrace of the museum on a beautiful night and singing out to the street, where literally people stop in their tracks and look up. And sometimes they're sitting in the cafes across the street having a glass of wine and shouting out, you know, brava, brava. And it's just, it makes us more aware, ourselves and our audiences, that we are part of the community, that it's not a separate entity, but we're interwoven. We also have, started doing some work with hospice and visiting nurses with grief counseling groups. And that has been a profound experience of empathy and understanding and the kind of community that can be built in a very short period of time. And the same is true of the meditations that we're offering now, mindful looking, both for adults. And I'm someone who tends to be, as they say, a monkey mind. Very hard for me to stay still in any way. And I've been going to those myself. And in the middle of the day and in the evening, it just kind of resets. And for our student population, where we've been offering that, it's been an incredible tool for them in a time that's highly stressful for them with all that's going on in the world, to have tools that help them reset, breathe, remind themselves that they have a way to kind of realign themselves with the calmness that sometimes can be lacking. So a variety of things. I'm happy to go into more particulars as you have questions.
Well, I have a big question here about the Santa Barbara Museum of Art is moving its kilns to the club on Cannon Perdido Street. Want to hear more about the ceramic classes and the camps to community youth.
We love the club. Mark Alvarado is bringing his true passion and heart into creating a kind of a hub where he brings in experts to offer classes to these students who are coming in from the community. And they have a wonderful space with everything from a basketball court to an incredible art room, really, with materials that we have more or less been invited to take over for our programs. And so we were able to move our kilns over there. They already had one kiln. We have a number of wheels, and we're able to offer ceramics classes to in this spring camp, in our after school programs. And eventually we'll move that into offering it to adults as well. But I just, in fact, this morning was going back and forth with Daniel Barnett, whom you may have talked to on this program. I don't know, Elizabeth, the head of VADA for many years. And he and I are talking about creating a real partnership between VADA, which just has to walk across the street, to be mentors for younger students, to have open studio time themselves. So it's really helped us, as many of the collaborations we're doing, extend ourselves more out into the community, just as we increase the size of what we have on site at the museum.
Well, thank you for that. I want to ask Amata a question. Whenever I go past the McCormick House, I think about, you know, it was given to the museum, I think, Catherine Dexter McCormick, 1967. And then in 91, Lord Paul and Lady Leslie Ridley Tree established the Education Center. They renovated and transformed it, et cetera. I'm thinking that, how do I explain this question? It must have been an interesting decision to sell it, because I don't think it was in very good shape. Last time I was there, it wasn't in the greatest shape. And I'm wondering, tell me about that decision, Amata.
Well, the McCormick House, you know, has had this, you know, obviously very important, wonderful, rich history for 33 years. It was the education center of the museum, and Patsy and her team have had extraordinary programs there. But it's an old house, and as we all know, old houses take a lot of maintenance. So we did a full assessment of the facility last year, and we discovered that there were some repairs we were going to have to make, which were actually quite substantive and quite expensive. We also were going to have to bring it up to current code, and that was also going to be quite expensive. These conversations actually started before I got here. The board was certainly looking at all of this, and we started talking about this again last year and looking very carefully. You know, you don't make these decisions lightly. But in the end, we really had to make the choice of whether we should invest in a building or should we invest in people and programs. I personally believe that it's more important to invest in people and programs. And the board decided unanimously to actually take that route, sell the facility, and whatever funds we get from the sale, we would actually put towards funding our education programs. So the spirit of the gift from Catherine McCormick to essentially support education programs continues through the sale of the facility, so that we actually can hopefully sustain these education programs forever. So not an easy decision. On the other hand, we'd actually feel quite good about the decision, because it's just everything that Patsy and her team do is so impactful, so important, especially now with all these cuts to arts programs in schools, that we feel like it was the right decision to make.
I want to talk a little bit about the artists that work with the students, teaching artists, I believe they're called, that are with you guys. I met one of them not too long ago, and I thought, you know, very gifted artist in her own right. And I understand that you go into schools.
We do.
Tell me more, Patsy.
We do, and in community groups as well. Some of our teaching artists have been with us for more than 20 years. We have Itoko Meno, who is a gifted illustrator of children's books in her own right, as well as an incredible teacher. Jason Summers, who specializes in preschool education, and he is the kind of the magic Mr. Rogers of our team. And we have Nicola Gerson, who is a gifted artist, and she has just grown in power. I won't go through and name all of them, but these teaching artists have different skills and work best with different age groups. And some of them are very good teaching with adults. And some of them, we have a program which is called ArtReach, which goes on to school campuses and provides and fills the gap from the fact that that school might not have an art teacher or might only have art once a week for each child for something like 30 minutes. So we're able to do a series of programs because part of what we believe is that it's that idea that it's a kind of a scaffolding of skills, and you don't just go in once and make one project and leave, but these students are learning the sort of studio habits of mind, how to take care of things, how to respect each other, how to start over when you make a mistake, how to make mistakes the starting point of something new and more exciting than maybe what you originally intended. So they're in various K through 12 schools. They're also in after school programs like AOK, which is a district sponsored program. We have them on junior high campuses as well. In fact, at La Colina, we've been doing a series of mural projects in their courtyard to kind of beautify a space that was somewhat blank, working with the students to express their own identity. We have Spanish speaking teachers who are able to work with our newest arrivals in Santa Barbara who might not yet be proficient in English. They are a welcoming, creative, flexible team.
So I think my last question, Richard, I want to know, do we have to go to quick break? Okay, let's go to quick break. And then I want to talk with Amata. I think the show that's opening next, Math and Art, March the 30th, this is super interesting to me because I think about the division, you know, the old Enlightenment philosophy division between art and logic. And I want to talk about the choice of this exhibition. I think it's so prescient right now, where the world is such a dualistic world at the moment. I'm thinking about the two opposing camps, you know, clear science and clear creativity never come together. And this seems to tell us that indeed it does. And I want to talk a little bit about math and art. I mean, out of all the shows, I'm most excited about that one to see how that's presented. When we get back from the break, Amata, would you tell us a little bit about that and the choice of that? And you talk about warmth, humor, and messiness in art that I think is fairly geometric, but I want to hear more. When we get back from the break, don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. Great honor and pleasure to talk with the director of our Santa Barbara Museum of Art, Amata Cruz, the education director as well, Patsy Hicks. I wanted to talk a little bit about the show that's opening on March 30th. It's called Math and Art, being curated by James Glisson. I wanted to ask Amata, the choice of this is very interesting because mathematics is not necessarily a topic of the art world. And that's been a division there since the 17th and 18th century. But I want to know more about the show, Amata, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking. Yes, that show opens on March 30th. And it is a show that is primarily drawn from our collection. We have a really wonderful collection of modernist works and also some constructivist works, all that really have this geometric look. And I don't want to necessarily speak for James because this is his show and his authorship, but I think he was quite intrigued to show that many of these things that we think of as just sort of hard-edged, perhaps cold, are actually a little more complicated perhaps than that. That artists, although they might be using geometric forms, are actually thinking about things like color and nature and reflection and light and all those things that we think of as just sort of art, right? As opposed to science. But I also think that dichotomy between art and science is something that artists are really interested in exploring because they see most artists see the world in very sort of fluid ways. And they like to question things. So I think anytime we have these sort of thoughts that perhaps might be a little bit more traditional, we really look to artists to question all of that and open our own eyes and minds to other possibilities. So I think the show is going to be really a surprise to many people because, you know, can I say that this work is beautiful? I certainly think it is, but I don't think many people would think of it when you talk about a show that is about math, let's say, or geometry.
Nancy, this must be an opportunity, though, to sort of look at art through the eyes of more of the logical mind.
Yes, it's an opportunity to really think across disciplines, which is really in tandem with all that Ahmad has been saying about our exhibition schedule going forward. And in fact, just this morning, I got an email from a math teacher at Westmont College who was intrigued by the little blurb that was online and wanted to know if they could find out more about the artists in the show and what was involved. And I actually wrote them back and said, yes, but I'm wondering if you and your students might want to create lesson plans for junior high and high school students based on the principles that you see embedded in this artwork. So
how cool.
We haven't heard back yet, but it's that kind of conversation that happens. And I think it's opening up our minds. And I was not a math person, I must say, but the beauty of proportion, even in our antiquities collection, we have online lesson plans that talk about that in a mathematical way. The golden mean, there are all these things. There is an order along with the creativity that is a kind of a scaffolding for these things. And I love the beauty of a pure color in an ordered form. I just think it's an opportunity for us to invite teachers to come in from other subject matters that might not necessarily always be drawn to come to the art museum, and for art students also and visitors to recognize that there is a mathematics behind the beauty that they see.
And I guess finally, I want to talk about V and Sora, because I understand that the museum has purchased a work, and we're also having a show that opens June 22nd called Outer Worlds. Ahmad, we don't have much time, but in the last 5 minutes or so, can we talk a little bit about that choice?
Yes, absolutely. So again, this is James Glisson's exhibition of the work of Vian Sora, and she's a wonderful, wonderful painter. The museum is lucky to have a beautiful painting by her named Dilmun of 2022. She is originally from Baghdad and moved here and now lives in Louisville, Kentucky. She has actually come to the museum in the last year to give a couple of talks. So there, she has a little bit of a local fan base, which is very nice. And her career is really taking off in a lovely way. You know, the work is colorful. It is, you know, sophisticated in terms of the way she thinks of color. It's also multi-textural. So when you look at a painting, you'll see some very thin washes of color and then some really thick impasto. It very much references the natural world. Interestingly enough, when she and her husband were here last year, they went to Lotus Land, of course, and she was just completely bowled over because this lush landscape that we're so lucky to have here and certainly at Lotus Land is something that really informs her work. So I think people are going to be really surprised by the work, but also just really, you know, really charmed by it as well and really interested in it. It's just a really beautiful painting show, and she's a fabulous artist.
You know, I really like the idea, not the idea, but the actual execution here. The show in 2025, in summary, I just am celebrating the fact there's such a female voice running through it.
That's right.
And an international voice as well. And that was one of the things I thought really important. You know, here's an artist born in Baghdad that's female, et cetera. And then, of course, the show... Rose Salane, and then we've got also the Latin American
we actually do have an exhibition on view right now called Accretion, and it is a group exhibition which shows the work of Latin American women artists contemporary. And these are women that live in the United States and also abroad. So we are celebrating, you know, the diversity in this, well, the diversity in this culture, and also it's an international show as well. And again, you know, we sort of have that ability to do that because we have such a diverse collection. So it's really, you know, one of our powers, let's say. So we have a lot to offer, and we so look forward to welcome everybody to the museum and to our incredible education programs as well.
And I just want to say thank you both for coming on. And just to mention that Santa Barbara Museum of Art is one of the finest, if not, I think, the finest museums on the West Coast. We have a permanent collection that's absolutely vast. And we have a wonderful mission to integrate art into the lives of people through internationally recognized exhibitions and special programs and the thoughtful presentation of its permanent collection. And we're going to have extra funds soon to do a wonderful educational outreach, which we've been doing before, but it's going to be continued with greater veracity. And thank you both, Amata and Patsy, for coming on. I sure appreciate it. And especially Amata taking time from a really quite an exciting schedule to talk with us. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.